Hey there, and welcome to the latest episode of Mobile Wallet Marketing Made Easy, the podcast that helps you navigate the ever-changing landscape of mobile marketing.
Hi there, and welcome to another episode of Mobile Wallet Marketing Made Easy. I'm Kim Stewart.
And I'm Hazel Fruitman.
And we are happy to have you with us today. We're back with part two of our mini-series about cannabis banking laws, the Cole Memo, and the FinCEN guidance. Today we're going to discuss FinCEN filings in detail, and we're going to offer up our opinions about what financial institutions and state legal cannabis companies might do to gain solid ground with deposit banking accounts, transaction processing, and other financial institution transactions.
That's right. So welcome to this episode of our podcast, Mobile Wallet Marketing Made Easy. And I'll just let you know now that we're doing a part two of a previous episode on the Cole Memo and FinCEN report procedures and banking in general for the state legal cannabis industry. We're taking a big interest in the state legal marijuana business over the past year and a half, and we believe that as an industry, it should be one that has a framework and structure to safely allow for qualifying companies to do business if they were working in states or provinces in Canada that allow them to do so.
Right, so if you're not into legal marijuana, or you don't want to hear about updates in the industry, our library has more than 50 episodes in it, and we have a bit of something for everyone on the digital marketing front. Roughly 90% of our podcasts have nothing to do with cannabis or cannabis-related materials, so stop by at dominoresearch.com/podcasts and check out other episodes and topics that you might find interesting.
Right. This isn't a podcast about marijuana or cannabis. It's a podcast about a variety of industries and how they can best use mobile to build a better business. Our cannabiswallet.net platform is designed specifically for the cannabis industry, while our mobilewalletmarketer.com platform works for regular companies doing a variety of businesses, everything from automotive sales to real estate. We have online coaching, travel and tourism, even podcast marketing. So today's topic just happens to be the cannabis industry, and we do create around 10 to 15% of our podcast content with an eye to the market. It is growing so fast, and so many states are either voting or legislating some form of legalized cannabis sales that we feel it's important to address this segment of our market.
We also normally, about right now, do a two-minute rundown of how our product platform works. But we're going to skip that today, and we're just going to let you know that you can visit cannabiswallet.net or mobilewalletmarketer.com for plenty of info about how you can, what I like to call, harness the power of mobile to create cost-effective campaigns easily and quickly. Campaigns that enable you to have like an interactive relationship with your prospects, customers, and referrals. It's much easier than trying to create your own app. It's way cheaper as well. So you can leverage the power of big company technology and distribution instead of spending a fortune supporting an app that's not even going to break even, most likely, from an ROI standpoint.
That's right. So let's get moving. We have a lot of ground to cover in a short span of our podcast. In part one, we talked about the origins of the Cole Memo. Actually, we talked about all three Cole Memos. The Ogden Memo, the introduction of the Rohrabacher Farr, now
Rohrabacher Blumenauer now
amendment, and touched on some of the members of Congress like Rand Paul, Cory Booker, and Patrick Leahy, who are also supporting the legislation. We also talked about Attorney General Jeff Sessions and his crusade to stamp out cannabis in America, the return of civil asset
forfeiture,
and more. That episode is entitled The Cole Memo and FinCEN Reporting, Part 1. If you want to check out the archives after the show is finished.
So, on to today's actual topic, Part 2. We find that there are two states who are essentially leading the way in the financial sector of the cannabis industry. These two states are Washington and Colorado. And this is not meant to take away from any other states. Gosh knows we all appreciate Earl Blumenauer from Oregon to step up and take the lead on the Rohrabacher Amendment. If you didn't know it, Dana Rohrabacher, who's a Republican from California, been a huge supporter of the industry, has stated that he's not going to run again next year. We also expect good things from California's Cannabis Banking Working Group. They did some hearings and meetings over the course of the early to middle part of 2017, and they're going to publish a report later in the year. We're expecting good ideas. So back to the topic. After the Cole memo, the third one, the 2014 edition, was published, the Department of the Treasury's Financial Crimes Enforcement Unit, which we're going to refer to, as everybody else does for brevity, as FinCEN. These guys published some guidance of their own.
Now, why is it called guidance?
Well, that's a good question, Hayes. It's called guidance because it's not a law specifically. If you know how American civics work, only Congress makes laws at the federal level, and guidance is therefore subject to change when new laws or new directives might be issued. So U.S. government agencies like the DOJ, the FTC, FinCEN, FCC, these guys all publish guidance, which is designed to help law enforcement and the courts determine how to proceed when they are dealing with potentially illegal behavior. Now, Washington State, as I mentioned before, is, in my opinion, leading the nation with how they manage the financial aspects of the business, and Colorado is another really good one. Washington State was the first state to vote in recreational adult use back in 2012, and that vote actually pushed James Cole to release his third 2014 memo, which is sort of the unofficial law of the land in cannabis today. Now, the Washington State program is titled I-502, and it's really rather comprehensive in how they manage their industry at the state level. They initiated seed-to-sale record keeping, and they did that more in an effort to protect their business owners from federal prosecution than anything else. So this means that part and parcel, from the root disposal to what dispensary buys what individual plants, is all tracked and recorded as a means to prove that compliant businesses are operating within state law, and they can prove this and provide documentation anytime they're asked to prove their compliance.
So compliance is a big issue here.
Compliance is the issue. Cole, FinCEN, Rohrabacher, Blumenauer, every single one of these things is related to businesses and protects businesses that are compliant with state laws. Now, each of them at the moment is specifically worded to include medical use and not recreational use, but so far the federal enforcement hasn't attempted to single out rec use as out of scope with the guidance or the amendment. You know, that could change soon. I think one of the things that's going to be really interesting to watch is, given the fact that California and the current federal administration seem to be going to war on many fronts, recreational use marijuana in California may become a real hot button issue and a sticking point in January of 2018.
And that's right. Recreational use is a state legal in a number of locations now, but there is no provision for it in any of the federal guidance as of now.
Right, so let's get back to the topic of FinCEN, what it says, what the documents might mean.
Right, but before we do that, we want to stress that we are not attorneys. These are opinions. And if you're in the business or thinking about getting into the business, you should consult with your own attorneys to get a legal option that actually has a lawyer behind it. We're not telling you to sell cannabis, grow cannabis, or buy cannabis.
So true. Do not take our word for any of this. Laws change. By the time this actually goes to publishing, everything could have completely changed. And if we publish this afternoon, it could be the exact same thing. So FinCEN dates back to February of 2014 with the guidance that it published. It was actually Valentine's Day of 2014. And it relates to the Bank Secrecy Act, which we're going to call BSA from here on out, the anti-money laundering laws, which we're going to call AML from here on out, and how financial institutions might reconcile the fact that while marijuana is still federally illegal, remember, it's a Schedule I drug on the books, even though more than half the states in the United States have some sort of a voter initiative, or, you know, now we're starting to see legislative initiatives that enable medical or adult rec use and regulate the purchase of cannabis under state laws. So there's some interesting language in the introduction to the FinCEN guidance documentation. And let me quote it for you here. This FinCEN guidance clarifies how financial institutions can provide services to marijuana-related businesses consistent with their BSA obligations and aligns the information provided by financial institutions in BSA reports with federal and state law enforcement priorities. This FinCEN guidance should enhance the availability of financial services for and the financial transparency of marijuana-related businesses. So if we break this down carefully, you can see that FinCEN is not saying that banks and credit unions and other financial institutions cannot provide services. They're simply saying that if a bank chooses to provide services, and they do actually address the circumstances under which a bank may determine that they can provide services, that there are some serious rules and regulations that cannot be ignored.
Yes, they use the words provide services and enhance the availability. That doesn't sound like a blanket don't do that to me.
No, me neither. But FinCEN also can't come out and tell the banks to do this business or that they can do this business since marijuana is a Schedule I drug and it's still illegal as far as the feds are concerned. So the next part of the guidance details, yet again, the parts in the Cole memo that refer to making sure that minors aren't accessing the drug isn't being shipped across state or international borders, criminal enterprises like drug cartels aren't participating in the business, and you know, there's a few other common sense bits in there about weapons and drugs and impaired driving, and preventing the cultivation or use of marijuana on federal property.
So it looks like there's a clear case that it can be made for a bank or a credit union to participate in banking marijuana businesses. And given the fact that using a bank helps to increase public safety, tax billions of dollars in cash transactions out of the shadows and into tax-paying trackable paths, it makes a lot more sense for banks to work with the industry than to refuse to participate.
Yes. Okay, so that is true. But let's not forget that banks are about money. They're about making money. Banks have shareholders. Credit unions have members. The management of banks and credit unions have a fiduciary duty to the stakeholders. That does involve generating a profit or, in the case of a credit union, meeting their goals. And it does not mean that they should go out and have their funds seized because they're participating in illegal activities.
Okay, got it. So how do banks and credit unions go about handling the business?
Okay, well, first thing, a bank or a credit union has to determine that they're going to do the business. This isn't one guy at the bank deciding he's going to take these accounts, or at least it shouldn't be. This is a situation where the banks and the credit unions, the board of directors, the upper management, they all get together, they decide this is what they want to do, they go and talk to their examiners, they talk to their lawyers, they talk to their board of directors, they talk to their BSA officers, all these people, their regulators, and they get the nominal go-ahead. So two things are at play, FinCEN and the IRS. Now, these are two different bodies, and there are two different sets of rules here, even though they're interconnected. The IRS tracks large sums of cash as a matter of record. It doesn't matter if you're a bank, a casino, a car dealership. If you have a business and somebody comes in with more than $10,000 in cash, U.S. dollars, there's a requirement that an IRS Form 8300 be filled out and submitted. Now, this is the same thing when they ask somebody who's traveling across the border, coming into the United States, whether they're U.S. or non-U.S., if they have $10,000 in cash or instruments of cash in their possession.
That's right. I come across that all the time as I cross the border. So if your business receives more than $10,000 in cash from one buyer as a result of a single transaction or two or more related transactions, so if you're a hospital and someone doesn't have insurance and they pay a bill that's $15,000 with two separate payments of $7,500 each, then the hospital has to file the form?
Yes, that's actually the way that it works. any business, not just a bank, not just a credit union, not a financial institution, they're subject to this rule. They have 15 days to submit the paperwork to the IRS. Now, the rest of the requirement is that the companies also need to furnish a written statement to each person whose name was included on the 8300 form by January 31st of the year following the transaction. The statement has to include the name, the address, the contact person, and the telephone number of the business that filed the form, the aggregate amount of reportable cash the business was required to report to the IRS from the person, and that the business did provide this information to the IRS.
Okay, so that's definitely something that's going to happen.
Indeed. Now, the regulations also allow for companies to file suspicious activity reports for almost any amount. Doesn't have to be $10,000. So the difference in a suspicious activity report, which I'm going to call a SAR from here on out, and the 8300 IRS form, which I'm going to refer to as 8300 from here on out, is that a SAR filing is not reported to the person or company that it was filed about. Not only that, it is specifically not supposed to be reported. FinCEN, the Treasury, gets the SARs, and they decide whether or not to investigate, act on them, hand them off to local law enforcement, prosecute, etc. Now, for marijuana-related industry businesses, FinCEN has a more stringent regulations for SAR reporting. The lower limit is $5,000, not $10,000. It's ongoing, and it can include amounts of less than $5,000 if need be. So there are three types of these filings. Number one is the marijuana limited. Number two is the marijuana priority. And number three is the marijuana termination. Now, I also want to note here that SAR reporting is unaffected by state laws. It's pretty time-consuming for financial institutions since most of them manually handle getting the documentation together to submit the forms and submit the filings. Once you're doing filings, every 90 days you have to do a new filing. And if you fail to file, that can result in fines for the institution, or it could even mean jail time for somebody if there's a deliberate action to aid criminals by failing to file.
So what do the different filings represent?
Okay, well, Marijuana Limited, that's the base filing. It's used by financial institutions to let Treasury know that they believe, to the best of their due diligence, that the company is following state laws and is a compliant business in that state. So it's got four parts. Part one is identifying information of the subject and related parties. Number two is the address of the subject and related parties. Number three is the fact that the filing institution is filing the SAR solely because the subject is engaged in a marijuana-related business. And number four is the fact that there's no additional specific activity that has been identified.
So the vast majority of businesses should be covered by a limiting filing, provided they are conducting their business under state laws. This means that they aren't being written up for failure to comply with seed sale regulations, they can document their cash transactions against their sales totals, and they know who they are doing business with, and those companies or people are allowed to participate in the business.
Yes. So we have some other rules and regulations that apply, one of which is the Know Your Customer rule, which came in with the Patriot Act, along with the BSA and the AML. So these rules all provide the basis for the guidance. So if you want to bank or process as a financial services institute for the cannabis industry, you have to make sure that not only your direct customers are legitimate, and you need to be able to assure that the examiners and auditors, you need to be able to tell the examiners and auditors, yours, that their customers are also legitimate. So this makes for a lot of work on the due diligence side. But at the end of the day, the choice is either don't bank, abide by the rules, or somebody's likely going to go to jail.
All right, so let's move on to the marijuana priority filings. What's that about? I see that the wording is based on the bank believing the customer is potentially breaking the law. How would a bank know that their customer is breaking the law to begin with, especially since they're already breaking a federal law by being in the industry if the money has touched the plant, as we call it, when someone is dealing directly with the physical product?
Well, that's really tricky and subjective, if you ask me, but I think it's potentially designed to give the banks a way to CYA, you know, cover their asses, in case there's a question in their minds about what's happening. Now, if a bank knows that a business owner has had their license revoked or been suspended, then that customer is for sure going to get a priority filing. So the text of the priority filing reads like this. Details particularly relevant to law enforcement in this context include identifying information of the subject and related parties, addresses, no news there, that's in the other one as well, details regarding the enforcement priorities the financial institution believes have been implicated, and the dates, amounts, and other relevant details of financial transactions involved in a suspicious activity.
Well, they're essentially asking the banks to spy, or is it something else?
Yep, that's right. That pretty much sums it up. They are asking the banks to spy. BSA and AML laws have already turned the banks into spies on their customer base, and this is not restricted to cannabis businesses. If you run a financial services institution of any kind, whether you're check cashing, money transmitting, payday loans, banking, credit card processing, gateway, you know, whatever. If you believe there is suspicion of illegal activity, you're supposed to notify the government. If you don't and you get caught at it, you can be violating a lot of rules. Now, there is one thing I want to point out here with the limited filings is that when the limited filings are coming in, most of the time at this moment, FinCEN says that they don't really pay much attention to them. They file them, they know, but they're not really doing any sort of deep search investigating on them. I will say as well, if there is an offshore bank or processor involved in any of this, and it's a non-US component, I guess is the best way to describe it, and there is a problem, and there is a priority or a termination, then it's possible that foreign corrupt practices could also come into play here.
Okay, so what about the marijuana termination filings? They are just for businesses that have lost their banking?
Not exactly. So if you go and you get a bank account under false pretenses, or you used an existing bank account to route marijuana funds and you didn't disclose it to your banker, these accounts would be terminated for terms of service violation and should be subject to marijuana termination filings, even though there were no limited or priority filings previously. You know, if the bank truly suspects that you're doing something illegal, they'll file a termination when they close your account if they've been doing the limited and or the priority filings. You know, the weird part about this, though, if they were filing marijuana priority SARs early enough, then the Treasury Department or some other law enforcement agency may actually ask them to keep an account open so that they can track the transactions as part of an investigation. So, you know, it's hugely important to make sure that you as a business owner are not doing anything shady and that your customers and vendors are reputable as far as you can determine. You know, the due diligence on the part of the financial institution, that is a time-consuming and expensive process. Many banks, they don't want the hassle. They don't want the ongoing due diligence. Their board of directors or their upper management doesn't want to risk their business. And so they make the claim that it's against the law for them to bank you because they just don't want to get involved with marijuana.
So far, there's nothing that says that a bank can't work with a cannabis business.
Right. There's not. At least not the way it reads if you read it in plain English. You know, there's tons of big banks and some small ones that somehow take it that way or they want to take it that way. And there are misrepresentations all over the media that claim that banks can't legally work with cannabis companies. Now, if you read the guidance, that's incorrect. You know, if you look at the scope and the breadth of what they're asking for and you realize that the penalties for failing to do the due diligence can be really harsh, you know, like for instance, there's one part of the termination filing that bugs me. And it's the part that refers to companies that are named something besides, you know, like Joe's Dope Shop. And the text of it reads like this. A customer seeks to conceal or disguise involvement in a marijuana-related business activity. For example, the customer may be using a business with a nondescript name, such as consulting, holding, or management company, that purports to engage in commercial activity unrelated to marijuana, but is depositing cash that smells like marijuana. Okay, so that is like super confusing because reasonably speaking, the majority of cannabis businesses are not going to call themselves Joe's Dope Shop. And it's not because they're hiding from the government, but because they run into enough issues trying to pay bills or get services that, you know, blatantly advertising their business type can make it so much harder to run a compliant business. I mean, you know, there are lots of companies that want nothing to do with cannabis industry businesses, in large part to the misconceptions out there about working with them. So this drives business owners to be nondescript when they name their businesses.
Right. But if you look at Apple, for instance, their name is just Apple. That's how they are trademarked. They don't call themselves Apple Computer or Safeway. If you didn't know that they were a grocery store, you just saw the name Safeway, what would you think of that? Like what it is? Self-storage? Armored car service? I mean, seriously, this could apply to tons of businesses in any industry. If someone just named their business after their last name, that wouldn't necessarily indicate what they're doing. Lockheed Martin, Ford, Amway, none of these business names taken solely as a name indicate what's behind the curtain, so to speak.
Yeah, that's right. It's a very subjective situation, and I think it's likely designed that way on purpose. It allows for almost anyone to be considered under a cloud of suspicion, not just marijuana companies. So I think that the termination filings, when they come up for companies that didn't disclose the nature of their business, that's probably in the beginning how FinCEN were seeing most of the terminations come through. So they had it worded in there to offer the financial institutions an easier out if they didn't want to bank marijuana or if they changed their minds and didn't want to bank marijuana anymore.
So it's not like that even need a reason to terminate, really.
No, they don't really need a reason to terminate. Anytime a bank or a credit union becomes uncomfortable with an account, they should have the ability to easily divest themselves of that account, at least in my opinion. You know, we're treading a very fine line here. And if you have business owners who don't want to be compliant, those guys should not be allowed to sour the pool for everyone else who works hard to maintain their compliancy and adhere, you know, they're with the proper disclosures. They stay on track. They run a solid business. These guys should not be punished.
So at the end of the day, cannabis companies can get bank accounts. It's not illegal. It's just against the terms of service for most financial institutions. And until there are more ways to enable banks to monitor compliance and automate the process, it's not always good business for the banks to take on these clients.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, if you're running a bank, and you have to hire 10 people to manage your 10 cannabis accounts, are you going to make enough profit from those accounts to pay for these 10 people? It's one of the reasons why banks charge these super high fees to open and service the accounts. Now, you've got like MAPS Credit Union in Oregon. They're bucking the trend. They offer super cheap accounts relative to the rest of the industry with some limitations. I don't know how they can afford to do it, but they're doing it. Yeah, the other thing we have to keep in mind is that banks cannot do all of their business in marijuana. That's a ridiculous risk assumption, and for so many reasons. You know, we talked about Fourth Corner Credit Union. These guys attempted to open up shop in Colorado just as a cannabis credit union, but the Kansas City Fed refused to certify them, so they couldn't get routing numbers and SWIFT codes.
So that means they were just a safe, not a bank. Without the ability to transfer money between other institutions, there's no real bank involved. The federal judge in the case against the Fed said they could apply with the Fed again once the laws were changed, but that the Fed could not be compelled to certify them under the current charter, no matter what the state did.
Right. And I hope, personally, that the California Cannabis Banking Working Group is paying close attention to that case. They've talked about starting a public bank, but, you know, a public bank that has no ability to interact with other banks, well, still just a safe, not an actual bank.
Okay.
And I think it's going to be interesting to see how it all plays out. I know everyone is looking at banking, how to get banking, what kind of banking makes the most sense, that sort of thing. I feel like we're going to start to see implementations sooner rather than later. Now, the last FinCEN disclosure report about Q1 of 2017 stated that there are nearly 400 financial institutions that are openly banking the cannabis industry. In the scheme of the vast number of banks in America, that's not a lot. But 400 is not an insignificant number when you look at the compliant businesses in the industry. Now, I also saw the other day that Wells Fargo in Ohio opened up an account for the Marijuana Policy Project office in Ohio. So MPP, if you're not familiar with it, they're an advocacy group. And back in July, their bank account that they had had for 20 years was closed down by their original bank because the bank determined that they were a marijuana business, even though they're an advocacy group.
Right, they're an advocacy group. So the ongoing saga of what level of association with the industry qualifies as being a marijuana company and what does not. So with that, we're wrapping up this episode and we'll catch you in 2 weeks with the next one. Have a great week.